Today is February the 21st, 2018. Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. This is the original personal computer radio show of all things computing. I'm Hank Key and my colleague is Joe King. Podcasts of the program is available on wbai.org/archive, also available on prn.fm, and on our website pcradioshow.org. We are on WBAI-FM 99.5 on the radio and PRN.FM on the internet each Wednesday with essentially the same program. However, WBAI is in a membership drive tonight, so the programs are slightly different. Google has introduced Gmail Go, the newest addition to its line of Go apps that are slimmed-down versions of their original counterparts, meant for phones with basic specifications and lower-end processors, or places with poor connectivity or expensive cellular data prices. Gmail Go will still allow you to have support for multiple accounts, automatically filter social and promotional emails, while prioritizing emails from friends and family, receive new mail notifications, and have access to 15 gigabytes of free storage, and read and respond both online and offline. Some non-essential features may be missing, such as images won't load automatically, for example, so that it can use less ROM and RAM. Gmail Go is available now and joins other Google Go apps like YouTube, Files, and Chrome Go. Google has a big ad blocking update for Chrome, and here's what we know. Chrome browser will begin to automatically filter out ads that don't meet certain quality standards. Google planned to integrate some form of ad blocking into its browser that would be on by default. There has been a gradual rollout of the feature, beginning with the ability to mute autoplay videos with sound on the sites of your choosing. Now Google going all in with a set of criteria for what ads will be approved in Chrome. Along with Facebook, Google is a member of the Coalition for Better Ads, an industry group that has performed research on what form of web advertising annoys people the most. It created a list of 12 types of web experiences that should ideally be avoided by advertisers. Now Google is going to enforce that list with Chrome, which is used by over half of the people accessing the web with a browser. The 12 ad types that Google Chrome will be blocked by default. Google will take a sample of various pages on a specific domain and analyze whether that page is serving any of the offending ad categories. It'll be given a score of passing, warning, or failing. Sites that don't measure up to get a passing grade will be notified by Google, and they can review an ad experience report for details on what needs to be changed. If a site ignores multiple warnings, its ads will be blocked by default after 30 days. If a user visits a site that's being filtered by Chrome, they'll see a message in the address bar that gives them the option to still allow ads on mobile. Users will see a pop-up at the bottom of the screen, and that will give them the same option. Yes, pop-up ads are blocked, and Google will be informing you with pop-up notification. The internet is getting harder to navigate and more annoying with advertisers demanding more obtrusive experiences every day. Google claims that since it kicked off this initiative, 42% of sites which were failing the better ad standard have resolved their issues and are now passing. So it seems that a lot of site owners got the message before it could even become a problem. There's also cause to be skeptical, however, of Google's altruistic goals. It's hoped that a better experience will mean fewer people feel the urge to download a third-party ad blocker. That's good for the internet, which is largely funded by ads. But it's particularly good for Google, which controls around 42% of the U.S. digital ad market and 75% of the search ad market. Google has assured us that the company isn't offering any kind of paid whitelisting now, and isn't planning to do so, but things can change. Consumers Report issued a finding that there are TV security flaws. Your TV can be controlled by hackers. It's based on an investigation by Consumer Reports that found millions of smart TVs don't do enough to protect your security. Consumer Reports has found millions of smart TVs from major manufacturers can be controlled by hackers, exploiting easy-to-find security vulnerabilities. The problems affect Samsung television along with TV models made by TCL and other brands that use the Roku TV platform. While evaluating smart TVs for data privacy and security, Consumer Reports came across a vulnerability in some smart TVs that can be easily exploited by a hacker who could write code to control the TV without the user's permission. Consumers Union was able to demonstrate how a hacker could potentially take over your TV by changing channels, playing offensive content, or turning the volume up and down, and all this without your control. This happens because many smart TVs have a programming interface called an API that lets you use your smartphone or tablet as a remote control over Wi-Fi. In some cases, Consumers Report found that this API was not properly secured and that could let a hacker control your TV. The Google search engine is removing the View Image button from the search results to make pics harder to steal. At least that's what they say. Google is making a change to image search that sounds small but will have a big impact. It's like removing the View Image button that appeared when you click on a picture, which allow you to open the image alone. The button was extremely useful for users, and I found it to be very useful myself, since when you're searching for a picture, there's a very good chance that what you want, you'll find what you want to match what you want. However, if you have to go through each page or each website to look at what you want, that would be very tedious. An example is, I'm looking to buy a bunk bed. Well, there are many designs on bunk beds. They come in different sizes, different style, and for me to go through each website on bunk beds would take forever. If I hit the View Image button, I see all the bunk beds pictorially or on a scrolling screen. That's what I want. However, Google says the change is essential and it was meant to frustrate users. Google has long been under fire from photographers and publishers who felt that image search allow people to steal their pictures. Hey, if you think that people can steal your pictures, don't put it on the internet. And they feel that the removal of the View Image button is one of the many changes that's being made in response to this. Look, if you're afraid of someone to steal your picture, don't put it on. But I know the real reason why you do want this. Because when you put up those pictures on a website, people have to click through it. They want those clicks. What I find to be very annoying is that you are looking at something that's very enticing, like the 10 most beautiful campuses or the 10 best looking whatnot and so on. You go through that list and you think that you would see all 10 items on one page. No, you click through one, you click again for page two and so on. And what you really want to see because of the headline is the last item itself. How do you get to the last item? You got to go through from the beginning. Can I tell you what I do now? I just bypass it all. Well, the intention seems to be either stopping people from taking an image altogether or driving them through the website where the image is found so that the website can serve ads and get revenue and so people are more likely to see any associated copyright information. Well, that may be great news for publishers, but it's a very annoying additional step for someone trying to find a picture. Well, now you have to wait for a website to load and then scroll through it to find the image. Websites sometimes disable the ability to right-click too, which would make it even harder for someone to grab a photo they're looking for. Hey, there's a workaround on that. Don't use the Google search engine. Use Bing. I found that if you use the Bing search engine, the image tab is there, and it'll give you the same function that Google is presently giving. While it's good to see that Google is protecting photographers and driving traffic to websites, it's still, you know, it's hard not to be a little annoyed by the change. There's plenty of legitimate and legal uses for copyright images, and while it's fair to ask users to do their due diligence by making sure they properly attributing photos, these changes really seem designed to stop images from being grabbed in the first place.
HP introduced a new laptop machine called the NVX2 using a Snapdragon processor. Well, what operating system was on it. Windows 10 ARM. Well, what is ARM? ARM stands for Advanced Risk Machine. Risk, of course, means RISC, Reduce Instruction Set Computer. Using simple instructions, well, how does that differ from the Intel machine, which uses complex instructions? An example is, in a complex instruction machine, A plus B equals C, and that's how you would express it. However, in the case of a reduced instruction set machine, what you do is you store the value of A into the accumulator, you add the value of B to the accumulator, and you store the accumulator value into location C. It's a little more instructions, but supposedly it runs faster, and it's more streamlined, and doesn't have to support legacy hardware, and that's the difference between the Intel Complex x86 or the x64 CPUs. Is it faster than the complex machines? Not really, but if you don't have to support legacy hardware, well, it should run faster. ARM is architecture that was developed by Acorn Computers in the 1980s. There are many companies that manufacture ARM processors: Qualcomm, Broadcom, Apple, Nvidia, Samsung, Applied Micro, and many others. There was an attempt. Actually, it was not an attempt. It actually happened. Microsoft released Windows RT back in October of 2012. And it was really Windows 8 running with an ARM processor. It didn't work out very well in terms of the way it was marketed. And the big problem was, yes, it will run Windows applications, but not all Windows applications. And of course, that wound up killing the Windows RT. In February 2015, Microsoft made it official. They just said, no more. Well, actually, they still have the coding for that, and all they had to do was, and what they did was, they modified it, brought it up to date, called Windows 10 ARM. And with this new architecture of Windows, they were able to convince a number of manufacturers, of which HP was the first, to release a laptop that uses Windows 10 ARM with an all-day battery life, and it's called an always-on computer. In other words, you never have to turn it off or at least 20 hours. What killed Windows RT back in 2012 was that it did not run the regular Windows apps that we're all familiar with. Yes, it ran Office, but it was a different version of Office. So what makes this go around a little different? They're saying you can run Windows applications that runs on an Intel machine on the Windows 10 ARM operating system. Well, is it all programs? Well, Microsoft finally released documentation on the limitations of Windows 10 on an ARM processor. Number one is that it will run Windows applications if they are designed and released as 32-bit architecture applications. 64-bit apps will not work. Yes, Windows 10 on ARM can run Windows desktop applications, but it can only run 32-bit applications, not 64-bit applications. Certain classes of apps will not run. Utilities that modify Windows user interface, like a shell extension, input method editors, assistive technologies, and cloud storage apps, will not work in Windows 10 on ARM. They will need to be recompiled for ARM, and it's speculated that this will not happen in most cases, especially in the next year. It cannot use x86 drivers. You have to have drivers for Windows 10 on ARM that can run 32-bit code. It cannot utilize x86 drivers. It will require native ARM64 drivers instead. This means that hardware support would be much more limited than is the case with mainstream Windows 10 version. In other words, it will work much like Windows 10 S does, the way it was announced. There's no Hyper-V. This was a gray area, and it's just Windows 10, so it will work, but now it's real. Hyper-V is not supported in Windows 10 on ARM. Older games and graphics apps may also not work. Windows 10 on ARM supports DirectX 9, DirectX 10, DirectX 11, and DirectX 12, but apps and games that target older versions will not work. Apps that require hardware-accelerated OpenGL will also not work. It's an interesting list, but it's not completely damning as most people, as it is suggested that with Windows 10S, the first year will be tough for many who do not adopt this platform, and it's so often the case with platform shifts, you're better off sticking to new stuff and letting go of legacy, since much of the latter either won't work or it will just run slow. But things are happening where Microsoft is not completely dependent on Intel architecture. Tonight, we have a number of fascinating feature segments. From Dr. Alfred Poor, wearable and health technologies covering telehealth helps with weight loss, fitness bands can diagnose diabetes, and a flexible fabric stores electricity for wearables. And from the Tech Corner, from me, an interview with Dr. Nick Van Terheden, who is a leader in digital healthcare and innovation and former chief medical officer for Dell. And from Marty Winston on home automation, how he mapped out 30 Raspberry Pi Model 3 units in a grid for sensory control.
Hello, this is Alfred Poor with news about wearables and digital health technology from Health Tech Insider.
Don't look now, but the end of February is upon us. It's coming next week, and soon it'll be March. And I've got to ask you, how are you doing on those New Year's resolutions? Chances are many of you listening had a resolution to lose some weight, don't we all? I'm wondering how that's going for you. Part of the problem is that we have this impression, this feeling, that it's our fault if we can't manage to lose weight. One of my favorite sayings is, I've got plenty of willpower. It's just the won't power that I'm weak on. It's hard to lose weight by yourself. That's why people join gyms, so that there's some sort of accountability for them to exercise and do whatever. But an interesting study has now been published that uses telemedicine approaches, telehealth, using video conferencing with healthcare workers to support obese patients who were trying to lose weight. And they created two groups, a control group, and then the test subject group had access to a dietitian and to a physician on monthly video conference calls. And the results were kind of astounding. At the end of the 6-month study period, the test group lost an average of about 16 pounds, whereas the control group only lost an average of about 3 pounds. They found that 9 out of the 13 subjects in the test group achieved clinically significant weight loss, while only 1 out of the 12 in the control group did. So this is a pretty strong case for telehealth technology. You don't have to go to the doctor's office and take the time for that round trip and all that stuff and waiting in the waiting room. Instead, you do it at home with the computer or your smartphone or whatever and get the support you need. And apparently, according to this study's results, it can pay off with lost weight. So maybe your best hope for losing weight is to get involved in a program where you can have access to healthcare professionals to keep you on the straight and narrow. More than 100 million adults in the U.S. have diabetes or pre-diabetic conditions. This is a serious health problem. It costs the country billions, and it's a problem around the world. One of the big problems, though, is that a lot of people don't get diagnosed with diabetes until they start exhibiting symptoms. Then it's more expensive to treat, it's more difficult, and often leads to insulin shots and so forth. If we could identify people who were pre-diabetic sooner and get them into treatment programs that would keep them from becoming diabetic, it would be better for the individuals and it would be better for us as a society, as we would save a lot of money on healthcare costs. A recent study by some researchers at the University of California, San Francisco, they looked at data that had been generated by your typical wearable fitness device. Basically, any of these devices that can track heart rate. This would include a fitness band like a Fitbit, and it also includes many smartwatches like the Apple Watch. And what they were able to determine was, looking at a ton of data, they were able to find correlations between the heart rate data and whether or not the person was normal or pre-diabetic or diabetic. It was able to do this with an 85% accuracy. So this would be a very simple, unobtrusive way of screening people, another tool for health screening, to help determine whether or not people are likely to be candidates for developing diabetes further down the line. Here's just another example of how an artificial intelligence system is able to wade through just mountains and mountains of data to come up with useful information that could change lives. One of the problems with wearable devices, especially for health tech, but for others as well, is that they need to have power. And most of the time, power means a rigid battery, either rechargeable or replaceable. And it's difficult to design around that rigid device. It's not flexible and doesn't conform to the curves of the human body and the changing shape that you have typically on most parts of the body. So power storage, a way to store electricity, is a real problem for many wearable devices. And if we could come up with better solutions, we could make wearables that would be less obtrusive and easier to work with and more comfortable and presumably would be more readily adopted by people. Well, scientists in Singapore have developed a new fabric that will actually store power. It's a flexible fabric and it acts as a supercapacitor. Now, this is a special kind of energy storage. A capacitor is something that can hold electricity and can store it quickly and discharge it quickly, as opposed to a battery, which can typically hold more power in the same volume, but it takes longer to charge it and can discharge the electricity slower than a capacitor can. Well, a supercapacitor, or supercaps as they're sometimes called, they have the best of both. They have the large capacity of a battery, but have the rapid charge and discharge features of a capacitor. And so this new fabric is actually a supercapacitor, but it has this random structure to it, which makes it very powerful as a device. It's not only flexible, but you can actually cut it and it will keep working. So you can cut it into all kinds of shapes and patterns to help it stretch more, for example, and it will still store electricity. Now, if you cut a battery, it stops working. So this is very different in its concept from a battery. They stretched it to 4 times its original length, 1,000 times, and it still is able to store electricity as if it was new. So this is a really interesting development. Obviously, it's still an experiment that's in the labs, and it'll be a long time before we see something that, like this on the commercial market, most likely. But it's an important step in a new direction that could help make wearables easier to wear and more useful. For more information, go to healthtechinsider.com. This is Alfred Poor. Thanks for listening.
Thank you, Alfred. The following is an interview with Dr. Nick Van Terhaden. The interview was fairly lengthy but informative, so tonight we present part 1 of 2. The rest of the interview will follow the next week.
Hey, Dr. Nick, let me ask a simple question because I have a hard time reading the last name. How do you pronounce your last name?
That's why everybody calls me Dr. Nick. They don't. It's Van Terhaden, but I'm known in the industry in part because of the difficulty with the name as Dr. Nick.
Okay, so it's Dr. Nick Van Terhaden, right?
Yep.
Okay. I'm not going to try again. When I saw the name, I said to myself, is this an MD or a PhD?
I'm a real doctor. I'm an MD.
Oh, what did you specialize in?
Emergency medicine.
The abstract I have from you is you're talking about incremental and exponential innovations. Can you take your time and explain to me what it is?
Yeah, absolutely. So I've been a strong believer in our ability to do a couple of things that we do, I think, relatively poorly in healthcare. And the first is learn from other industries and apply the learnings from those other industries to healthcare. And the second is take small steps. I believe it was Sun Qi, one of the famous quotes that I've heard is, every journey begins with a small step. And the principle behind incrementalism and incremental improvements is we need to make these small steps and small changes. I think a lot of people focus on potential for exponential improvements. And whilst I believe that we can reach those exponential improvements, and, you know, we often hear cited the Ubers of this world or the Airbnbs, when you go back and look at their pathway to exponential innovation, it turns out that it was full of all of these small little incremental steps. So I think the combination of those two things, learning from other industries and specifically the small incremental steps that occur in other places that we can benefit from, and then specifically taking those small steps. And that actually proves to be a much lower risk strategy for anybody, because if you only take small steps, if they prove to be in the wrong direction, you haven't caused yourself significant damage or negative consequences, and you can actually improve very quickly and course correct. So it's a lower risk strategy. It also, in my view, gets you to that exponential improvement that we're all looking for in healthcare.
Well, I happen to agree with you on that, because last year, a great deal of money was spent in terms of crowdfunding and kickstarts and so on in the healthcare area, and many of the companies that I dealt with, they're no longer available. Everyone's looking for the wow factor, and the wow factor is it's there, but it's like it's a long shot.
Right. No, that's exactly right. I think, you know, we see a lot of people appear and disappear. I mean, perfect case in point coming up in the very near future is the large healthcare IT conference, and I go to that on a regular basis, and what I notice is this sort of constant cycle of companies that appear and disappear. And, you know, if you try and take off too much as part of this process, what you tend to do is you put yourself at a higher risk of failure, because you put so much into this, and if it proves to be, you know, poor choices or not economically effective, it can be the downfall. And, you know, my sense of healthcare is that there are so many opportunities for these small incremental improvements. And ultimately, that's what patients are looking for. You know, when you're down in the trenches and you're a patient and you're struggling with simple problem, I'll pick an example that I just find very compelling. You know, simple inhaler. Asthma is one of the biggest challenges, not just for children and parents of children, but also adults who struggle with these inhalers that ultimately were really quite complex to deal with. It required a lot of coordination to press the device and to trigger that at the same time as you inhaled and a big breath inhale. And we can actually design a device that takes all of the complexity out for a child especially, but I think it applies to adults as well. It says instead of asking them to do all of this, why not just trigger it in a way that says you create a trigger that's in the device so that all they have to do is to breathe in quickly and abruptly, but the device will do all the other triggering and get the drug into your lungs. And it sounds simple, but it actually took years to arrive at the patient interaction. And, you know, from my perspective, we ought to be doing more of those small things. What are these small changes that we can make in terms of design or in terms of perhaps workflow, simply locating departments in a facility next door to each other to improve the overall workflow so that it just becomes the natural course as opposed to forcing people to insert themselves into what seems to be an inappropriate workflow. And I think there's tremendous opportunity in that for innovation.
There's a lot of truth in that. But however, I know that tremendous advancements have been made in medicine. And is this in any way skewed expectations by patients and the general public?
Yeah, you know, I think there is a risk of this sort of, future expectations. And, you know, we see these things, not just in terms of science, but also Hollywood. I think Hollywood has done a pretty good job of building out expectations of what might be possible. I mean, we've been looking at Star Trek since back in the 60s. I was a huge fan. And, you know, we had Bones with his tricorder and, a touchless interaction. You know, we look at that and some of us, you know, perceive that and say, well, gosh, that's a long way away. But I think we're setting some level of expectations. And that specifically happened in speech recognition. We saw speech recognition back with one of the early episodes of Star Trek. And people confused what they saw on Star Trek with the computer and conversing with that computer with, you know, some of the products that we've seen emerge over the course of the last, 10, 15 years. And what you saw on Hollywood was a very complex product that wasn't just pure speech recognition, you know, converting what somebody said and turning it into text, but it was actually doing that, but also understanding it. Very, very difficult process, that natural language processing, and indeed artificial intelligence, as people reference it today. And then turning that into knowledge that can be applied and responding with the spoken voice back, a computerized voice. So there is some risk of that. And, you know, obviously we have to counter these sort of expectations that are past our capabilities. But I would also, you know, call out folks like Elon Musk, who, quite frankly, you know, has stood up and said, no, we can launch a rocket as a private company. Oh, and by the way, we can land the boosters back on, you know, the Earth. He achieved that, not just with one, but two out of the three, albeit one was lost, but, you know, truly outstanding. And, you know, I think that aspirational goal is important as well in the context of incremental improvements. And I'm sure that he reached it through small changes and innovations that took place within his organization, but all of it driven by that aspirational goal. So I think the aspirational piece is still important in all of this as well.
Well, how much can we advance medicine if the government exercises a certain degree of control and non-control? Because it seems like it's either all or nothing.
Yeah, so, you know, the role and responsibility of the government in the delivery and the innovation in healthcare, I think, you know, sometimes gets confused. There are times when, you know, government involvement is important, you know, perhaps in terms of setting standards, for example. You know, when you think about the development of the internet, ultimately, you know, the IP addressing and the process and the protocols, a lot of that, some of that was developed, you know, with agreement amongst the various parties, but some of it was developed through regulatory oversight and, you know, bringing people together. So I think it's a balancing act. But most of this innovation, I believe, comes from enabling the potential of all of these Einsteins that sit out in our community. It's incredible when you go out and talk to these individuals, you find that people have incredible insights, particularly if they're involved, you know, especially in healthcare. If you deal with a problem day to day, what we find is, you know, many of these people can be innovative in their own world. A diabetic who gets frustrated with the process of glucose monitoring that's done with a stick process, and then they have a pump that's disconnected, they've got to manually enter all that data, but is also a programmer and a builder of technology, essentially built themselves an artificial pancreas that took that data, processed it with the algorithms and all the understanding that we have, but essentially automated that process. So freeing that potential from those individuals, I think, is going to be our key to driving this incredible opportunity to really improve healthcare and change the way that we deliver it. Broaden access, ultimately, because we'll bring down the prices as we do that, and ultimately improve the overall quality as we bring in more of this technology that helps support the human elements of this, which is what we all want out of healthcare, is a humanistic healthcare delivery system.
Do you have any strong views about herbal medicine or non-Western medicine? Because it seems like when I was in China they practice herbal medicine as well as Western medicine, and somehow they're able to blend both in. Do you think that can work in the United States, or do you think it really, I don't know how to express it, it won't work?
No, I think it's getting over our sort of own prejudices and paradigms that we have that, you know, if it's not coming from, you know, our standard of science, you know, we tend to reject it. But when you look back in history, and, you know, it's fascinating. I had the privilege of spending a couple of weeks in China with a group that was looking at both Western and Chinese medicine and all sorts of it. And, you know, I think the key is to actually understand the value proposition. And herbal medicine is a fantastic example. If you take a whole host of drugs, aspirin is a fantastic example. That was herbal medicine. We you know, it comes from plants. You know, the idea that, you know, we can't derive value from these herbal remedies, I think, is just short-sighted. because so much of our learning and our capacity to sort of drive healthcare and improvements in health has been driven by the discoveries. Digitalis, that's another one that people typically know of. But there are so many more. And sure, we're going to construct molecules outside of this herbal world. But I think there's so many opportunities to learn and find and discover. And the idea that you discount or discard that, to me, is short-sighted. Now, that doesn't prevent people from being resistant to it. And I think we have to educate. And importantly, we have to validate it. So there are opportunities for, confusion as to the effectiveness. And I think one of the ways that that tends to occur is with the placebo effect, which actually proves to be extraordinarily effective. So I can give you a pill. It can essentially contain sugar or some equivalent, an inert substance, but it can actually improve a clinical condition. We can demonstrate that. And we've demonstrated that where I tell you that it's going to improve the condition and you're essentially duped or fooled. But it turns out that even if I tell you it's a placebo, but it is going to improve, it still improves, which is just a truly fact. That's the power of the mind, we think. We don't fully understand it. So teasing out those instances, and I think importantly, one of the things I'm very passionate about is preventing people from being duped and fooled with what I would call snake oil or things that are not providing value. So I think it's important to sort of validate these things. It can be very hard to do so, but there's been some great work around this. And, if you discard it and discount it without actually investigating, I think you do yourself and your community a disservice.
I think that one of the problems that contributes to that is that you get a lot of advice and it keeps changing. In other words, it keeps changing and you confuse the public and you get to the point where you just ignore the whole thing. Now, the latest kick is organic food.
Yeah, no, I we've certainly seen a lot of that where there's challenges with the overwhelming amount of both advice and evidence and teasing out what's real and what's not. And what has scientific validity can be very challenging. We don't all grow up with good statistical backgrounds to be able to understand the data and understand whether there is, good control measures within a study, for example. One of the interesting things that I saw recently, and in this case, it's a technology or a potential technology solution, was the use of artificial intelligence that in this case wasn't for that, but I think could be applied in the same principle. And what this did was it took the privacy statements that occur or are produced on many websites and essentially applied an artificial intelligence and summarized it based on science and understanding. Now, obviously, that AI has to be good enough to do that. But I can imagine the same kind of thing starting to occur where we start to develop known agents that can apply this knowledge and start to tease out where there's real value and real science so that we can make informed decisions. It is complex for patients. And I'm a physician and I get overwhelmed with this data. But ultimately, I think I believe most people want to make the best possible decision with the best available data today, and I think we do a poor job of presenting that in a form that people can consume and understand. And let me pick another sort of hot topic for me that, I feel the medical profession has done a very poor job, and it's around vaccines. So I don't believe for one second that there's a parent on this planet that gets up in the morning and says, I want to do my child harm. That's just, it's implausible to me. Yet there are parents that essentially make decisions to either not vaccinate, and there are some good clinical reasons where that's the case, or they make decisions to change the vaccine schedule based on what they've learned and understand. And to me, that's a failing in clinical knowledge and the sharing of information and the education. We have failed them to help them understand why they should be vaccinating to the schedule, and here are the benefits, and here are the justifiable reasons why you can't, and here are the reasons why you should be vaccinating. And I'm not trying to get into a vaccine war. I respect people's opinion, I truly do. But if we're failing to communicate effectively, I believe firmly that they're making the decision that's the best possible one for their child. They couldn't be doing it for any other reason. And so we've failed on some elements of this, and we've got to get better at communicating effectively.
The remainder of the interview will follow the next week.
Marty Winston will be talking about setting up 30 Raspberry Pi Model 3 units in a grid for sensory control.
I'd like to tell you about 30 things this week, but fear not, because all 30 are pretty much the same. This has to do with our cybernetic house project. 40YearHouse.com has some information. And, you know, I have a feeling, you know, if I was really vain, we'll call it Winston's Law, but no, somebody probably already thought of it. I think the smarter the endpoints, the smarter the system when you have any kind of a cooperative network system like we do in the cybernetic house. We're dealing with more than 100 computers, most of which are Raspberry Pi, $35 Raspberry Pi 3 Model Bs. And they're wonderful little computers. They're 4-core 64-bit CPUs. We can't use the 64 bits because the OS isn't there for it yet, but it is plenty fast. There's a gig of RAM, which is a limitation. SD can boot it and do some other things. It's got some pretty good peripheral drives, a nice GPIO for hooking up other stuff. But, you know, it's a Raspberry Pi. It is what it is. It was made for education, not even for the prototyping that we're doing. 30 of our 100. 30 Raspberry Pis have a specific job to do. They are our CAP units, our CAP nodes. CAP is my acronym for Ceiling Awareness Pod. The CAPs are on the ceiling throughout the house, primarily, not exclusively, but primarily to take advantage of the ability of a Panasonic grid eye sensor to read an 8x8 thermal map of what's underneath. That 8x8 thermal map is how we track warm bodies through the house. It's also, which is a part of the automation, it's also a part of how we find trouble in the ventilation systems or in the insulation. We'll get into more of that another time, and we've been in it before. This week was finally an opportunity to peg down exactly how we're putting the CAP together. And I think that might, I dearly hope, that might interest you. In these 30 positions, the CAP is in the middle of the room. The smallest room is roughly, 10 by 15, 10 by 20, which means, actually 11, not 10, but it means up in the center of the ceiling, it's only 5.5 feet to the nearest wall. I'm a believer that automation in a house should not be obvious. So the CAP is in the middle of the ceiling in a standard two-gang electrical box with a not very spectacular cover plate on it. Get into that in a second. Up in that CAP, we have a variety of sensors and, more important, a variety of connections. Now, all of these CAP nodes are in the control intranet that are all linked to each other. It's 100 megabits with a Raspberry Pi 3 Model B. They can send messages back and forth, even issue and respond to commands or confirm using MQTT, which is kind of a telegraphic protocol that IBM developed. They also all connect to a MySQL server, which is a wonderful data gathering. We'll get into that again at a different time. In the Raspberry 3 itself, there are several sensors. One is a triple play sensor, a very, very nice thing, the BME680, which measures pressure and humidity and temperature. The BME680, it's I2C, that's a two-wire way to communicate, which is very handy. The MAX 44009, ambient light sensor. As for sensors, that's pretty much it, other than, of course, the GridEye. There's one other thing there are a couple of other things in there that are important in this little tiny electrical box. There is a couple of watt Class D audio amplifier. There are two tiny speakers, each about the size of a stack of 3/4. There are four infrared emitters, fairly high power, directed so their beams go at the four walls. They're going to issue TV remote control commands. I'll get into that in a minute. And since we don't know where the TV will be, you know, brute force, watch the walls. It's three more infrared emitters than I might otherwise need. You know, we've got a single chip universal remote control in there, driver for those LEDs. We've got an audio amplifier, two small speakers, and those small speakers, of course, are near little gridded holes with mesh behind them so that they can get enough audio into the room. They're part of our doorbell system. I say doorbell, but doorbells in our case is a library of dozens of sounds that signal when appropriate. And again, that's for another time. One of the things that we really, really treasure is how small chips have become that are all compatible with the I2C bus. I2C is inter-integrated circuit, also called I2C. It's a clock line and a data line and a power and a ground, and that's all you need to it. So we have this little box with a Raspberry Pi in it and a main circuit board, kind of a daughter board to the Raspberry Pi, but only attached directly with two wires and mechanically through the four corner posts. The main housing of the box is attached up in the ceiling, but the cover plate holds most of the electronics. The cover plate is fairly plain. The little tiny holes for the sensors are almost invisible. The LEDs, the infrared LEDs or IREDs that are in there look like bumps. They're not much of anything. And the holes, the little vent holes that the speaker sound come out of, also nondescript. So here's a plain cover up there with a nice little circuit board fastened to the inside, and it's got to be fastened pretty tight to the back of that plate because these surface mount the electronics, the sensors and so on, don't have another way of getting close to the outside of the plate where they're doing some of their measurement. So we've got so far some environmental sensors there, but there's more to it because each of these also connects over a short wire, a little less than a foot, to another little attic sensor, a sensor that's up in the attic that has, again, that pressure, humidity, temperature sensor and an ambient light sensor. And that same little board also gets inserted into the vent. And the one that's in the vent, of course, needs to be sealed. Why do we look for ambient light in a vent? Well, if it shows up, there's trouble. We want to know that. What we're doing here is taking, so far, sensors, and so far, a remote control chip, and some drivers, and an amplifier. But in that room, we have more work to do. We want to keep track of the switches on the wall. The light switches don't actually connect to line voltage power. They're signal switches that tell the Raspberry Pi to tell the network, to tell the digital addressable lighting interface controller, the Dolly controller, turn this light on, turn that fan on. It also means we can use that switch for other purposes to signal that an occupied room is now vacant or vice versa. In order to get those signals from wall switches, from magnetic read switches on doors so we know if they're open or closed, from whatever other switches we might have there, we set up another very interesting little GPIO expander, the MCP23017. That lets me connect 16 plain switch closures in a way that becomes an I2C input for the Raspberry Pi. So every time those switches close, we get an address on which switch is closed. We get an interrupt that says, pay attention to this. It all gets to be pretty much a lot more convenient than we feared. The high-side switch handles the current of driving all those LEDs on and off all the time. But we do run into a problem. A lot of the sensors, you know, the ones up in the duct, the ones in the attic, and the one on the face of the thing, are at the same immutable address on an I2C bus, and you can only have one item with that address on the bus. So we're using a wonderful little chip, the TCA9545A, which is a four-way I2C multiplexer. It breaks one I2C two-pin connection on the Raspberry Pi into four, one of which has those plate-mounted sensors and the Raspberry Pi and the audio, actually not the audio amplifier, but the remote control chip. All of those are on one I2C. One goes by cable over to the vent. One goes by cable to the attic, so we're getting those readings. And also on that main I squared C bus, the 16 switch GPIO extension interface. We're dealing with the Max-Q X17 infrared remote control on a chip, the GridEye, an 8x8 thermal scanner, the PAM8302, a 2.5-watt monaural Class D amplifier, the couple of small speakers, 4 high-power infrared emitters, an MIC940608, which is the high-side switch that handles all that power for all 4 high-brightness IREDs, the MCP23017 16 switch GPIO expander, the TCA9545A, that 4-way multiplexer for I2C, the MAX44009 in 3 places, the ambient light sensor, the BME680 pressure, humidity, temperature sensor, and all of that in this little box. I could go into more detail, but then we'd be running over into another show, wouldn't we? So all I can say is, don't forget, back up, back up, back up. Like Hank says, back up.
Thank you, Marty. Public service announcements of local computer clubs in the Northeast Tri-State region. The Brookdale Computer Users Group will have a presentation on voice-operated assistance. Thursday, February the 22nd, 2018. Meeting time is 6:45 p.m. They'll meet at the Middletown Library Large Meeting Room, located at 55 New Monmouth Road in Middletown, New Jersey. Princeton PC Users Group will have a meeting on Tuesday, February the 27th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. at Mercer County Library in Lawrenceville, New Jersey. The Westchester PC Users Group will have a presentation on different categories of artificial intelligence. Thursday, March the 1st, 2018. Meeting time is 7 p.m. at the Keller Williams Realty, located at 120 Bloomingdale Road, first floor in White Plains, New York. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey will have a presentation on iWork, presented by the Apple Store on Friday, March the 2nd. Meeting time is 8 p.m., and they meet at the Scotch Plains Rescue Squad, 1916, that's 1916 Bartow Avenue in Scotch Plains, New Jersey. Danbury Area Computer Society will have a presentation on infographics with Power BI on Tuesday, March the 6th, 7:30 p.m., and they'll meet at the Danbury Hospital Auditorium in Danbury, Connecticut. The New York Amateur Computer Club will have its general meeting on Thursday, March the 8th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., NYU Silver Building, located in Manhattan, New York. The Long Island Macintosh Users Group will be meeting on Friday, March the 9th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. They meet at the New York Institute of Technology on Old Westbury Campus, located at Northern Boulevard and Valentine's Lane, in the auditorium of Harry J. Schur Hall. TCF is March the 17th, Saturday. It is a computer festival featuring talks, workshops, and vendors. The theme of the festival this year is wearable technologies. It will be held at the College of New Jersey from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. For more information, the website is tcf-nj.org. The keynote speaker is Dr. Nick Van Terheden. Dr. Nick is a leader in digital healthcare and in innovation and former chief medical officer for Dell. The feature speaker is George Harris with a presentation on medical tricorders, taking science fiction into reality.
Our website is pcradioshow.org. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm on the Internet and at 9 p.m. Eastern Time on WBAI-FM 99.5 on the radio or WBAI.org streaming on the Internet. In the meantime, stay in touch and keep on computing, and remember, backup is very essential, so just back up. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King and Michael Horowitz, we thank you for listening. And in this weather we are going through right now, stay safe and healthy until we meet again, same time, same station next week.